I'd like now to welcome Kat Duff. She is a counselor. She lives in Taos. Her first book was The Alchemy of Illness, and her new book is The Secret Life of Sleep. She will be signing her book and will be appearing at Collected Works Bookstore this Thursday, the 3rd of April. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. I'm glad to be here.
So how did you come to write a book about sleep?
You know, I have always loved sleep. Even as a little girl, I used to say it's my favorite time of day.
For interesting reasons.
Yes, yes. I mean, it was just such a... You get to withdraw from the world and everybody's demands on you. You get to go inside. It's a very private time. But also in my work as a counselor, I started noticing about 10 years ago that most of the people who came to me weren't sleeping well. And if we could address their sleep issues first, whatever else they came for usually resolved or became much more manageable, whether it was anxiety, depression, attention problems, whatever. I began to realize that sleep is fundamental to our well-being.
Now, why is it that so many people aren't sleeping well?
Oh, it's the million-dollar question. There's a lot of factors. I think the first factor that came in was with industrialization and people starting to work out of the home, and having to work long hours outside of the home meant that they had to compress their sleep into shorter amounts of time. And then when you get more to our age, our more technologically advanced age, we have such an exposure to light. I recently heard that two-thirds of the American population cannot see the Milky Way at night. That's how much light has invaded our nights. And, of course, our ability to fall asleep relies upon our pineal glands secreting melatonin, and that's triggered by darkness. So between lights outside and the lights of our computers, our TVs, our cell phones, and so on, it's harder to sleep. But beyond that, I think we have a cultural attitude of dismissing sleep as something that we can always get to later on. If we're going to be productive, if we're going to be a success, we need to cut back on our sleep. It's one of the great American myths that I take back to Ben Franklin when he used to tell people, you can sleep in the grave. Right now, you got to work, you know.
Right, you can sleep when you're dead. I've
yes,
heard that.
Yes, absolutely. Uh-huh. And so we have...
Which isn't actually strictly true.
It's true. You're right. It is not true. Absolutely. Thomas Edison, who invented, you know, the light bulb that lights up our nights, he himself disparaged sleep, although he took catnaps all the time and relied upon his catnaps to get a lot of his ideas. He would sit in a chair and hold little steel balls in his hands, and when he fell asleep... and the balls hit the floor and woke him up, he would look for an idea.
Very interesting. Now, you write about those transitional times in your book between wake and sleep, kind of on both ends of it, falling asleep and waking up. And those are times that I think have been written about a lot in a poetic manner, but aren't all that well understood.
Yes. One of the things that I realized in doing my research in the neuroscience of sleep is that... I tend to think of us as myself as being either awake or asleep and nothing in between, but in fact, our brains kind of shut down one little part after another in a sequence, and so we can be both asleep and awake and have mixed states of waking and sleeping, and that naturally occurs as we're falling asleep and as we're waking up or if we're stirring in the night. And I think of those as very valuable times because they are opening a channel of communication between, we could say our sleeping selves and our waking selves, we could say our conscious and our unconscious, we could also say between our little ego-encrusted worlds and all that is around us, the forces of nature, the ancestors, all the beings that are out there. We're more vulnerable and open when we're in those mixed states. We are not so attached to our beliefs of what's real and not real.
How well is the phenomenon of sleep understood from a scientific perspective?
I think even the scientists would say that they're still scratching the surface on it. One of the ironies, of course, is that because the scientific method requires measurement and quantification of results, scientists weren't able to study sleep until they developed the EEG and the more modern brain imaging techniques. And so up until, you know, up into the 1950s, scientists in the West considered sleep to be just a period of rest and that's all, when nothing happened, when our brains just shut down, you know. Talked to people around the world, of course, and they understood it to be a very active and valuable time. In fact, ancient Hindu, Buddhist, Sufi texts all refer to the different stages of sleep that scientists have more recently identified and the value of each of those different stages. And scientists consider the question of why we sleep is still fundamentally unanswered. It seems odd to me because it's sort of like, why do you watch a sunset? Of course you do, because you want to. You can't help it. You know, it seems an odd question. We don't ask ourselves, why do we wake up? But we ask ourselves, why do we go to sleep? But there's still a huge amount has been learned. And one of the things that's interesting about the science of sleep is that it's very interdisciplinary, and it's exploding at this point.
What are some of the different disciplines?
Oh, gosh. There's everything from biology and evolutionary biologists. There's anthropologists, sociologists. There's lots of different kinds of scientists are involved.
Right, and I suppose also art, in the sense that there are people who are continually writing about and exploring dreams and sleep states artistically.
Absolutely, and artists and writers have always drawn a lot of inspiration from their sleep, and I think it was John Steinbeck who referred to his committee of sleep. If he had a problem, he would just go to sleep and let his committee of sleep work on it and wake up and have an idea of what to do. It's one of the things that out of my research that I've started doing a lot is taking problems to my sleep. Even little ones, like if I can't think of a present for someone and their birthday's coming up and I really want to give them something special and I can't think, you know, I just think about it before I go to bed, and the next day at some point usually it'll just click in, you know.
That's what a lot of people do also when they're taking a walk, or mm-hmm. for me sometimes doing dishes or folding laundry, that's yeah. where the ideas come.
Or the shower is a famous one too. Yeah.
Right. I know. Now, dreams are also a universal phenomenon that are understood in so many different ways and in some ways not well understood. Mm-hmm. Do we even know what dreams are?
Well, that's a good question. We understand, from a scientific perspective, we understand more the phases of sleep where dreams are more likely to occur and what's happening in our brains. And actually, during those rapid eye movement when dreams are more likely to occur, that stage of sleep, our brains are actually more active than they are when we're awake. We understand that the amygdala and the limbic system that kind of carries our emotional memories and our fight-or-flight instincts, that those tend to be activated when we're dreaming. So I think that's part of why so many of our dreams involve fighting and fleeing and doing urgent things.
And our dogs, too.
Oh, absolutely. I know they're chasing rabbits. They've even...
Who knows what they're doing?
Well, that's true. They have actually taken... There's one study of zebra finches, those tiny little birds. And they watched what their brains were doing when they were singing. And then they put those little electrodes on their brains when they were sleeping. And they noticed at certain stages in their sleep, they would go through the same sequence of patterns and realize they were singing in their sleep. And I think Coco, the famous gorilla, was able to tell people about dreams.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So evolutionary biologists would say that our dreams are where we practice and rehearse our instincts and our survival mechanisms. Others would say that, well, there's so many different kinds of dreams. And when I looked at studies of dreams around the world and in many different traditions, you know, from Ayurvedic traditions to Native American traditions, most every tradition would say there's different kinds of dreams. There's dreams when clearly you are being visited by a being of some kind. There are dreams that are more psychological when you're working out issues. There are dreams that are more physical that are letting you know what's going on in your body. There are dreams where you're just rehearsing and practicing skills you need to do. I've been talking to a lot of radio hosts, and they always tell me, oh yeah, half my dreams are of racing to get to the station in time to get on the air, you know.
Count me in.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. And
there's a lot of, in dreaming, there's also a lot of just sorting out the anxieties of your day somehow.
Absolutely.
So that you don't feel them the next day.
Absolutely. And the study on dreams makes it pretty clear that our angst, our anxiety, our tension around a particular issue is lessened over the course of a night of dreaming about it. Now, I have to say there's a caveat to that. There are some people who, if they've had a major trauma and they're suffering from post-traumatic stress, there can be kind of a kind of re-traumatizing of dreaming over and over and over again what they've been through. It's sort of like a stuck record. And in that case, you actually want to reduce the amount of dreaming. It's one of the ways that antidepressants work is they reduce dream time. And for some people who are stuck in a traumatic loop, that can be needs to happen is to reduce that. But as a general rule, they do help us work through our anxieties.
We're talking to Kat Duff about her book, The Secret Life of Sleep. Now, as you write, in some societies, dreams are considered kind of like public property, whereas in our lives, they're really private, and we mostly don't talk about them or usually don't even remember them.
Yeah, it was so interesting. It's actually, I mean, the more I researched about sleep, the more I realized that a lot of our practices and habits around sleep, a lot of our notions of sleep are more the exception rather than the rule in terms of human cultures around the world and historically. And our notion that dreams express our individual psyches is really more of an exception. The understanding more cross-culturally is that, cross-culturally is the understanding that we're part of a community, we're part of families, we're part of various circles, and we live and breathe with those circles. There are some who are the dream carriers, who bring in the dreams for the circles, for the larger community. There are artists who say that their inspiration comes from their dreams and they belong to the community and they need to come out. There are political leaders who've been inspired by a dream and brought forward. Harriet Tubman used her dreams to guide her path in the Underground Railroad. Peoples who have been less empowered tend to rely more on dreams and are more knowledgeable of the uses and guidance that dreams can offer because they need them and they use them.
Interesting. You had a friend who was a nurse and she used to use her knowledge to help others. She would have dreams about other people's medical conditions. Like one of them, which was really kind of almost spooky, was she had a patient and she dreamed that they had melanoma, even though there was no mark on their skin, and they did.
Yes, yes. She was a psychiatric nurse and psychotherapist. And so she had a lot of knowledge of physical ailments as well as psychological. Every now and then she would have a dream where she would just have to tell someone, you know, you should get such and such checked out. And
she was right.
She was right, yes, yes. And she also, she'd had cancer several times, and the last time she got cancer, she had a dream where she knew this one was going to take her out and called me up and said, you know, I know this one will do me in. And much as I wanted to argue against it, it turned out to be true.
Quite amazing. Now, you were talking a moment ago about how various pharmaceuticals that we take affect dreams in terms of reducing dreams, and that's considered healthy if the person's having super traumatic dreams. But what about for the rest of us?
For the rest of us, it is not so good. It's true. Most of the just about all of the medications out now for sleep reduce the time we spend in deep sleep, which is the restorative phase. That's a lot of the physical restoration, the building of bones, the regenerating of tissues and so on goes on in that deep sleep. And it also reduces the REM sleep when we do a lot of emotional reconciliation. So, and of course, these medications are only approved by the FDA for, at best, 6 weeks of use. They're not meant to be long-term.
But people use them long-term.
And I think of it as sort of accelerating aging to do that.
And there are some medications like Ambien, which you write about, that in rare cases, but nevertheless enough cases to be significant, causes people to not only sleepwalk, but sleep eat, sleep drive, sleep car crash.
Absolutely, sleep kill. I mean, there have been legal cases where Ambien was a defense, and most recently we saw that with one of the Kennedys. Yes, it's in fact the FDA has responded to that by lowering the amount that you can prescribe. But still, that is a risk. I have a friend who takes Ambien every night. She works a stressful job. She feels that's the only way she can get to sleep. But she often wakes up with breadcrumbs in her bed. She's been snacking on crackers and bread at night.
In her sleep.
In her sleep. She has no memory of it, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, yeah. That'll definitely affect your dietary plans.
Yes, yes. Yes, and there are people who, I also met someone once who had made this beautiful chocolate cake for her son's 7th birthday. And when she woke up in the morning, there was the print of a mouth eating the frosting off the top. And she realized it was herself that had gone in the night in her sleep and just mouthed the top of the cake.
Amazing, amazing. I'm sure she probably thought it was her son first.
Oh, of course.
So sleep, as you write about, has been really commercialized in so many ways by the pharmaceutical industry. And it's, I mean, a cultural pattern of we're all expected to work more than is healthy for us to work, be more productive than it's healthy for us to be productive, and then we have to get through it by drugging ourselves, which in the long run makes us less healthy and probably less productive.
Right. Absolutely. You know, Mary Charlotte, I was kind of shocked to read in my research that Americans are working the equivalent of one more month a year compared to 1980. So that's just in 30-some years, we are working that much more.
And we haven't added any months to the calendar that I've noticed,
no.
Which means...
we haven't. So, yeah, I mean, we are working more, and we are demanding more productivity of ourselves, or our bosses are demanding more productivity. And so we're trying to squeeze our sleep into smaller and smaller stretches.
And for single mothers, the numbers are even worse.
Oh, yes, 6 weeks of extra work, yes. Mm-hmm. A year compared to 1980. It's appalling. And the people who tend to be sleeping the worst or having the most struggles with sleep are middle-aged women. And that's usually because they are both working and caring for children, caring for elders, and having to squeeze that. Once they get older and they're past menopause, oftentimes that sleep gets better.
How do hormonal changes of middle age, particularly for women, affect sleep?
It certainly affects sleep, and of course, you'll often hear from women that the hot flashes wake them up a lot, and then it's hard to fall back asleep. There's a lot more broken sleep oftentimes as we age in general, but when you add the hot flashes in on it, it's more problematic. One of the things I learned in my research is that broken sleep, or you know, sleeping in stretches of a few hours at a time, is probably more of our natural pattern, and that it's the industrialization that's forced us, and the demands of work that have forced us to try to squeeze sleep into one stretch and to go fast asleep and wake up fast and move along. And so we're all on that chemical carousel of stimulants and sedatives, stimulants and sedatives.
There was an article going around Facebook a couple of months ago about the second sleep and how until the industrial modern era with electric lights and all that, people would go to sleep. Then they'd get up in the middle of the night and do things or hang out or whatever you can do with candles, I suppose, and then go back to sleep and have the second sleep. And that's what people apparently, even to this day, that's the natural rhythm that they will find if left to their own devices.
Exactly, yes. That historical research is by Professor Eckrich out of Virginia. He looked at sleep patterns in pre-modern Europe and the Americas and found that first and second sleep was very common. And actually, when you look at other pre-industrial cultures, that's very common, and historically it's very common around the world. And one of the interesting things, they did do, another scientist did a study where he actually took students and put them into an atmosphere where there was 14 hours of darkness, and then the rest of the day they could do what they wanted. But that's equivalent to a winter night in the northern latitudes. And what he found is that after a week or two, they settled into that same pattern of going to sleep when the darkness started, waking up 4 hours later or so, being awake for a few hours, and then sleeping again. But one of the things that this scientist, Dr. Weir, noticed is that the melatonin and prolactin, the hormones that are released by the pineal gland, they are very relaxing, comforting, satisfying hormones. They're tend to be very high in nursing mothers and broody hens, and it gives them that satisfied, you know, I'm doing the right thing in life kind of place that I've often envied. And when the students were sleeping in that pattern of first and second sleep, those hormones stayed high the entire night. But once they went back to their regular schedule of trying to sleep all at once, the hormones dropped off very quickly. So that capacity for a real calm, relaxed state of mind gets lost as we try to compress our sleep.
And the social consequences of that are immeasurable.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And when we don't get enough sleep, we're tend to take it away from that second sleep. And that second sleep is when we do most of our emotional resolution and sorting things through. So when that gets cut off, people tend to focus more on the negative. They tend to be more anxious, less appreciative. One of the most interesting things they have found out is they're less willing to compromise, less willing to resolve conflicts. So it has made me think, boy, we really, I would like to be able to require our politicians to get good sleep and get their second sleep, you know.
World peace through sleeping.
Yes. I know.
We're talking to Kat Duff about her book, The Secret Life of Sleep. Now, it's interesting that some of us are night owls, some of us are early risers, and yet it doesn't quite make sense in terms of the fact that, in theory, we evolved with the natural cycles of the rising and setting of the mm-hmm. sun, and night owls really only have come into their own during the era of electricity and light bulbs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, I mean, if I were to hazard an evolutionary guess as to why there's always been some 10% of the population that are night owls, I think that they are the ones up and awake while others are sleeping, so that someone's watching out to see what's going on. In pre-industrial cultures, oftentimes sleep is more communal, and there's oftentimes people awake while others are sleeping, and they shift in and out of those patterns. So I think it's a way where one person is always awake watching out for the whole group.
Enemies and predators.
Yes, 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 yes. And one of the things that surprised me in my research is that those tendencies, to be either a morning person or a night person, or someone more flexible in between that can kind of do both, are really physiologically ingrained in us, and they're very hard to train out. I have a friend who recently retired from teaching. She had taught all of her adult life, and within a month after retiring, she was back to being a night owl. And after, you know, this is after decades of being forced to be a morning person.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very, I know this myself, being a night owl in a morning job, it's impossible. And many of us have tried all kinds of drugs and all mm-hmm. that, but basically your best bet is to get a profession where you don't have to get up early.
Absolutely, that's the best thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of moral projections onto sleep, and most of them have to do with the idea that night owls are bad people and morning mm-hmm. people are good people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and one of the things that's interesting about that is that all of us, as we age, go through different stages where we're more likely a morning person, more likely an evening person. Preschoolers, even if they're by nature night owls, are more likely because of that age to wake up early and go to sleep more early. Teenagers, on the other hand, are by nature, the hormonal changes that come in with puberty turn them into night owls for a good 10 years. And so that's why they're always staying up late and sleeping late and being so grumpy, because they are always sleep deprived, being forced to go to sleep earlier. And I think it really adds to the alienation and isolation of our teens that we will not organize their lives around their physiology, and it isolates them.
Now, there are drugs, we were talking about drugs before, but there was a fairly new one that I'd never heard of called, is it called Provigil?
Vigil, yes. Yeah.
And that's a drug that basically supposedly has few side effects, and it just lets you postpone sleep till later? Is that what it is?
Yes. It gives you a good 36 hours before you have to sleep. And you don't have the jitteriness if you were trying to do that with coffee. You don't have the mania if you were trying to do that with other stimulants. You do eventually, of course, need to sleep. You don't have to catch up as much sleep as you do oftentimes. The military, of course, has been really looking into this for some time, because it's understandable if you're fighting a war, it's helpful to have someone alert and able to stay up for some time to protect everybody. And it is it's sold on the internet and become very popular with students, even amongst professors and intellectuals in the intellectual class, in the entrepreneurial class. People who feel like they have a lot of competition and they've really got to stretch themselves. And even those who don't want to take it, if everyone else is taking it, it makes them feel like they're going to be left behind if they don't. We don't know the long-term effects of this. And my biggest concern, even if it seems to be that there isn't a physiological or physical long-term effect, I worry about being able to go full tilt for that long without an interruption of sleep that allows you to return to the bigger perspective, think about the bigger picture, to question yourself, because a lot of that goes on in our sleep. We mull things over, we problem solve, we think about things. And if we're going full tilt and not having those interruptions, it scares me to think what kind of problems we can get ourselves into. You know, it's like careening down the ski slope without any, any path, and just hoping you'll turn out and land on your feet.
Well, there's so many ways in which we have skewed our lives out of the natural balance that we evolved with. And each time, just name your thing, there are unintended consequences that aren't good.
It's absolutely true. And I have a chapter in here where I go through the history of sleep medications. Each one comes forward, turns out to have its problems. The next one comes up. This
and
is
it's
the
a
great
miracle,
answer.
Right.
Yes. Uh-huh. And it just happens over and over and over again. And, of course, there's a new set of sleep medication that works differently, that's going through the process of trying to get FDA approved. There's a lot of hype about it out there now. Works with the orexin system rather than others. And there's always been that promise of the miracle.
So you are a counselor, and as you said at the beginning, you were trying to find out more about sleep to help your patients who have sleep problems, and when they are able to sleep better, a lot of their problems kind of go away or aren't so bad. Mm-hmm. How do you actually do that? How do you work with your patients?
Well, I do have questions about sleep in my initial intake now, so I can find out. And then there's a variety of ways to go about it. Sometimes it's a matter of just helping them, kind of some education about what are the best environments and ways to sleep, the importance of darkness. I talk to them about their lives and the demands of their lives, and we kind of problem solve together as to how to support that sleep. I also, one of the tricky things about sleep in our day and age, where we have so much information about how bad it is not to get enough sleep, is that the minute people wake up at night, they're worrying about not getting enough sleep. That, of course, keeps you awake, but it also makes the harm of not getting enough sleep much worse. If you aren't worrying about it, if you're realizing this is natural for people to wake up after a few hours, it's much easier and it has less impact long term. But otherwise, there's various herbal remedies that can be tried. There's melatonin that can be tried. Sometimes I use something called neurofeedback. We kind of problem solve together as to how that person can get better sleep.
Do people sleep better with animals?
You know, it depends on the person. Some people, people are so individual, and that's one reason why I like people to kind of figure out what is their way. Some people really are comforted by having a body next to them, and if it's not a person, then an animal is great. Even sometimes an animal's better because it's a better protector. Other times people feel trapped and need to not have someone else in the room. In our society, the Euro-American kind of tradition focuses on solitary sleep. We try to get our babies and infants sleeping on their own in their own rooms as quickly as possible. Most other cultures find that tantamount to criminal neglect to try to ask your child to sleep in another room in the darkness all by themselves. Communal sleep is more a part of our nature as creatures on this planet. But if you've been raised with more sleeping on your own, then you're more likely to find that more comfortable and feel kind of trapped if you have another person next to you.
Or a whole group of people who might be snoring.
Right, right. And there are others raised in a more communal context where they're only going to feel comfortable if they have a lot of people on them. I have a friend who is from a very traditional Hispanic family, and she was raised much more communally, always had, slept with all her siblings, and then as a mother has always been sleeping with her kids and had them around. If she has to go out of town for work and sleep in a hotel by herself, she can't sleep.
The book is called The Secret Life of Sleep by Kat Duff. Now, you will be at Collected Works Bookstore this coming Thursday, the 3rd of April, at 6 in the evening. Have a lot of people so far been reading and using your book?
Yes. It's just, the publishing date was the 18th, so it's just getting out now. But I'm starting to hear from people saying, I didn't get specific tricks or techniques about sleep from your book, but it was very comforting, and I have much more knowledge of my sleep, and for some reason, I'm sleeping better. My goal is to encourage people to engage with their sleep lives and to win their sleep back. It's a natural endowment. We are born with it, that capacity to sleep. We've allowed our lives to kind of steal it from us, and now they're trying to sell it back to us with all these drugs and all these machines and everything. We can sleep on our own. We can win our sleep back, and that's my goal in this book.
Kat Duff, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.